Lecture 20, Failed Movements in the Caribbean.
We have now seen about a dozen cases of successful wars for independence from the colonies and empires of Britain, France, Spain, and Portugal. Some of the American colonies, however, did not achieve independence in the age of revolution. Some chose not to rebel, and other uprisings were weak and easily crushed. In this lecture, I want to look at two cases of Spanish-American colonies, Cuba and Puerto Rico, that failed to achieve their independence in the age of revolution. We will also look at a third troubled case of the Dominican Republic, a nation that had to fight for its independence several times against Spain and in Haiti and in Spain again. These cases, I want to emphasize, show us the contingency of the processes in the age of revolution. They show that independence was not inevitable, and that despite the general patterns that we've seen, each case is unique. In all three of these cases, the delayed process of independence would profoundly shape the creation of new island nations, and in one case, a would-be nation. All three of these fall under the growing and powerful influence of the United States. Although most North Americans are generally aware of the power and influence of the United States in Latin America, it's a skewed perspective. In fact, for most of the history of the 19th and 20th centuries, U.S. power in Latin America is restricted to the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, to Mexico, Central America, and the islands of the Caribbean. The influence of the United States, especially direct influence, south of the Caribbean, is rare in the 19th century. It has very little influence on places like Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and for that matter, Gran Colombia. As I emphasized before, the connections between the United States and the nations that would become independent in Latin America go back to their common origins. Florida, Louisiana, Texas, all were once parts of Spanish and French America. As we shall see in this lecture, some of the islands of the Spanish West Indies come close to becoming part of the United States. And in one case, one island in the Spanish Caribbean does become part of the United States. So the histories of these nations and colonies are intimately interconnected across centuries. From the 18th century on, the strongest connection between the 13 colonies, the United States, and these islands was trade, especially in sugar, molasses, rum, and slaves. On the eve of the American Revolution, in the 1770s, one-third of all the ships leaving New York and Boston go to the West Indies. So this trading connection is long and strong throughout the colonial period as well as the 19th century. John Adams, reflecting on the importance of the West Indian trade in the tax disputes that opened the American Revolution, once said, "I know not why we should blush to confess that molasses was an essential ingredient of American independence." So I want to emphasize the connections go way back and is not something in recent history, and these connections that are strongest are through trade. In many ways, none of these three colonies that we're discussing was able to emerge as a fully sovereign nation in the century after the independence of the other Latin American nations. Cuba and Puerto Rico would not escape the clutches of Spain until 1898, and then they fall into the grasp of the United States. Cuba, although it technically achieves its independence at the turn of the century, for all intents and purposes, remains a U.S. protectorate into the 1930s. Puerto Rico will become a U.S. territory in the early 20th century. And eventually, by the late 1940s, Puerto Rico becomes a free associated state, the only one of its kind. Puerto Rico is both a part of the United States and it is distinct. It leaves behind colonial status, but it is neither independent nor a colony. The Dominican Republic will not achieve political independence until the 1840s, a full generation after the rest of Latin America. But it will be plagued by direct U.S. intervention, by intervention by Spain, and even after independence in the 20th century, it is plagued by dictatorships and U.S. military intervention. Now, slavery and geography directly contribute to the failure of independence movements in Cuba and in Puerto Rico. And I want to look at these two first. Much like Brazil and the U.S. South, the elites in these slave societies are reluctant to pursue wars that might trigger another Haitian revolution. Both Cuba and Puerto Rico are settled in the first years of the conquest in the 16th century. They are some of the first bases of operation for the Spanish conquest of the New World. Unfortunately for Puerto Rico, with the conquest of Cuba, the largest island in the Greater Antilles, Cuba becomes the most important Spanish base, and Puerto Rico, through much of the colonial period, is a military outpost, presidio. The Indians across the Caribbean die off in droves, and by the end of the 16th century, there are very few Indians left. Slaves will eventually replace them from Africa. Cuba, as the biggest of the islands, becomes the principal gateway to the Spanish Empire in the New World, the so-called Pearl of the Antilles. Havana is the main entry and exit point for most trade and traffic. It is the last stop east going to Spain of the Spanish fleet. Cuba, to give you a sense of size, in the late 18th century, probably has a population only of about 170,000. Blacks and mulattoes account for about 40% of that population. About two-thirds of those blacks and mulattoes are slaves. This is not the same as Haiti. Although it is a slave society, you do not have the overwhelming numbers that exist in Haiti. And despite an intensification of the slave trade in the late 18th and early 19th century, the white populations in both Cuba and Puerto Rico are much larger proportionally than in the other West Indian islands. Again, Saint Domingue is the other extreme. 450,000 population in the late 18th century, 400,000 of those are slaves. So in this sense, Cuba and Puerto Rico are more towards the middle of the spectrum, with a racially mixed population, but not a slave majority. The British West Indies, all of the British West Indies combined, have a white population only of 60,000. In Puerto Rico, only 10% of the inhabitants were slaves, but free blacks and mulattoes make up nearly half the population. It has a population in 1800 of about 150,000. So these are two small places in comparison with places like Brazil or Peru or Mexico or the United States. Geography also shapes the destiny of the Spanish islands in the Caribbean. By the mid-16th century, Central America, Mexico, the Andes, are the great wealth-producing regions of the empire. Yet Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Hispaniola Santo Domingo, are simply commercial and geopolitical gateways to empire. They become heavily fortified military positions. Cuba, in particular, Havana especially, is probably the most heavily fortified city in the Americas. And there's good reason for this. In the 17th century, the English, the French, the Dutch enter into the Caribbean and begin to attack Spanish possessions and Spanish islands. It's in the 17th century that the English, the Dutch, and the French take control of Jamaica, Barbados, Saint-Domingue, Curaçao, Aruba. It's also in the late 18th century that the U.S. emerges and becomes another force and factor in the region. Combined with the rise of slavery and slavocracy, the strategic location of these islands helped keep these three colonies what many historians have called ever-faithful isles. The planters and merchants would think long and hard about breaking with the colonial regime, longer and harder than any of their compatriots in the rest of Spanish America. In the end, these Creoles on these islands, especially Cuba and Puerto Rico, would gain the concessions they wanted and that their Creole brothers in the other colonies so desperately fought for. They will gain these concessions without independence. The first great shock to the colonial system in Cuba was the British capture of Havana in 1762 and the occupation. In 1762 and 1763, the British take control of the most important port in the Caribbean. With the Treaty of Paris in 1763, this island and Havana go back to Spain. It shows you something about senses of priority. The options for Spain are to relinquish Florida or Cuba. They choose to give up Florida because it's an unimportant frontier settlement and hold on to Cuba because of its importance as a gateway to the empire. Trade while the British occupy explodes dramatically. Havana is filled with British and American shipping. The Cuban merchants experience this access to an open international market and an end to an old commercial monopoly. In the twists and turns of these imperial wars and changing alliances in the late 18th century, this foreign shipping not only explodes legally, but also illegally. Once Spain regains control of Cuba in 1763, many British traders continue to smuggle goods into Cuba. The British, in fact, will acquire the monopoly on shipping slaves into Cuba. And as so often happens in this process, they bring with them more than slaves. They bring lots of other British goods. So I want to emphasize that British and U.S. traders are operating all over the Spanish West Indies by the beginning of the 19th century. Their influence makes the call for free trade by Creoles in these islands even stronger. There are those influenced by the movements of the late 18th century who will begin to discuss in Cuba and Puerto Rico the possibility of change. The Enlightenment and the American Revolution, the French Revolution, all have their impact in Cuba just as they do in all the other colonies we've discussed. There are some extraordinary, vibrant intellectuals and political figures, especially in Cuba, in the first decades of the 19th century. A few even speak of themselves as children of colonial despotism. Led by Francisco de Arango, the Cuban liberals, as in most of Latin America, tend to be much more concerned about liberal economics, about free trade and laissez-faire, than they are about liberal politics, freedom, and equality. Part of this is the impact of the Haitian Revolution. French planters cross the waters from Saint-Domingue, and some of them take up residence in Cuba and buy plantations. they will tell horror stories about the atrocities of the uprising in Haiti. This has a direct and immediate impact on Cuban politics and planters. They provide hair-raising stories that make these Cuban planters very reluctant to engage in any sort of conflict with the crown. They also bring with them capital and expertise. And along with increasing investment from the United States and U.S. planters, Cuba will be transformed in the 19th century. The misfortune of Saint-Domingue to collapse as the great sugar plantation of the Americas is the advantage for the Cubans. Cuba, in the 19th century, will become the great sugar plantation of the Americas. By the 1790s, the Cuban planter elites, the Creoles, have an ambitious program to expand sugar plantation and to expand slavery. By the end of the 19th century, Cubans will say, with justification, without sugar, there is no country. In a smaller and less dramatic fashion, the same sort of process is taking place in Puerto Rico, the rise of sugar and slavery. When the Napoleonic invasion takes place in Spain and Fernando VII is imprisoned, the same forces we've seen in the other Spanish American colonies are unleashed in Cuba and Puerto Rico. The Cubans call councils, assemblies, they have debates and discussion. Which way shall we go? At the same time, the young United States has acquired Louisiana in 1803 and Florida in 1819. Many U.S. political leaders, including John Quincy Adams, believed that Cuba would eventually be purchased and annexed to the United States. Thomas Jefferson, while he's president, quietly makes inquiries about purchasing Cuba from Spain to prevent Cuba from falling in the hands of the French or the English. The wars on the mainland also reinforce royalist sympathies on these islands. Some 20,000 fleeing royalists arrive in Cuba in the 1820s. Havana and San Juan become bases for royal troops moving on to the mainland to fight against the rebels. In the words of one Cuban historian, Cuba and Puerto Rico became, quote, the barns and the bastions of the metropolis in the New World. At the same time, conspiracies emerged that frightened the Creoles and the Peninsulars alike. A free black wood carver from Havana, Jose Antonio Aponte, organizes a plot in 1812 to burn the plantations and to lead slaves out of their bondage. He makes direct contacts with Haitians, and like many of them, he's inspired by African-derived religions. Aponte is a priest or a santero in the Santeria Afro-Cuban movement. The uprising in March of 1812 is quickly suppressed, and 9 of its leaders are executed. The importance of Spanish military presence and the danger of slave rebellions clearly weighs heavily on the minds of all white Cubans. When the liberals regain power in Spain in 1820, these events touch off yet another round of intense discussions about the island's future. But what's different about this from places like Venezuela and Mexico is the Cubans and the Puerto Ricans have 3 options: to stay with Spain, to seek independence, or to join the United States. In all 3 cases, they knew that their objective was to maintain the slave system so that the plantation agriculture would survive. Possibly fearful of U.S. intervention, the other Spanish American liberators never mounted a serious attempt to invade Cuba. This is interesting. They used places like Haiti and Curacao and Barbados as their refuge and bases, but they never attempt to liberate the main islands. There is an expedition mounted in the U.S. in 1822 by one of Bolivar's associates, one of these international mercenaries by the name of Holstein. It fails miserably in their attempt to invade Puerto Rico. Simón Bolívar once wrote Santander in their better days when they were still friends, "It is more important to have peace than to liberate these islands. An independent Cuba would take us a great deal of work." At the same time, the U.S. is very concerned about these islands, and Secretary of State Henry Clay declared in 1825 that, quote, "This country prefers Cuba and Puerto Rico should remain dependent on Spain." At this point, the interests of the United States are to keep the status quo. So as the mainland colonies of Spain achieve their independence, the government of Fernando VII manages to hold on to Cuba and Puerto Rico. By 1818, for all intents and purposes, free trade existed in Cuba and Puerto Rico. The trading system had opened. Spanish troops that remain help guarantee the social peace and reassure the nervous planters. So Cuba and Puerto Rico do not follow the paths blazed by South America, Mexico, and Central American colonies. They remain ever faithful isles throughout the 19th century. So there are the cases of Cuba and Puerto Rico. The Dominican Republic is very complex. It is probably the most complex case of any of these movements in the age of revolution. Once again, what today is the Dominican Republic occupies the eastern portion of the island of Hispaniola, one of the original Spanish bases in the Caribbean. Columbus's first permanent settlement in the New World is on the island of Hispaniola. The oldest European city in the Americas is Santo Domingo. But with the conquest of Cuba, the importance of Hispaniola and Santo Domingo diminish. So during the colonial period, it is a secondary center. It develops sugar plantations and slavery like the other islands, cattle ranching, but its principal purpose is as a port and a military outpost in the Caribbean. In the 1580s, Sir Francis Drake raids and pillages Santo Domingo. In the 17th century, the Caribbean becomes a battleground for contending imperial powers. And at the same time, Saint-Domingue begins to emerge on the western end of the island as a French colony. By the end of the 17th century, the French have laid claim to Saint-Domingue, and that end of the island grows rapidly. As we've seen, the sugar and slave complex in Saint-Domingue overshadows all the other sugar plantation societies of the 18th century. And it is much larger than Santo Domingo on the eastern end of the island. The outbreak of the Haitian Revolution initiates a half century of struggle in Santo Domingo. As we've seen from 1791 to 1803, the French, English, and Spanish fight over this entire island during the Haitian Revolt. In 1800, Toussaint Louverture occupies Santo Domingo. And although the Haitians throw out the French troops in 1803, Napoleon continues to have troops stationed in Santo Domingo on the eastern portion of the island until the British forced them out in 1809. When the junta takes power in Seville during the French occupation, they will reclaim this territory of Santo Domingo. French officers that remain on the island attempt a revolt to take power, to challenge Spanish control in 1811 and again in 1812. This leads to a slave uprising, and once again, it is brutally repressed. The local government in Santo Domingo is so poor, they cannot even finance local administration, and military officers. The financing to pay for this, in fact, comes from other sectors of the empire. The Haitians' principal concern for years is to keep out the French, so they want to take control of the entire island. And I want to emphasize how important this is. These two colonies on the same island shape a very powerful history of conflict and tension that continues into the 20th century, into the 21st century. Haitians at this moment in the early 19th century outnumber the Dominicans 10 to 1. And again, the population of Haiti is overwhelmingly black and African. The Haitians will invade and take control of the eastern portion of the island in 1822, led by their president, Jean-Pierre Boyer. Haiti will dominate the entire island from the early 1820s until the early 1840s. It's only in 1843 and 1844, an entire generation after the end of the wars in the rest of Spanish America, the Dominican Republic comes into existence. Juan Pablo Duarte leads the fight against the Haitians to create an independent Dominican Republic. And today he's recognized as the national hero of the Dominican Republic. Independence is officially proclaimed on February 27, 1844. Again, I want to emphasize how late this is in comparison with all the other cases we've seen. Like much of the Caribbean and Central America, Dominican politics over the next century, from the mid-19th to the mid-20th century, is dominated by a series of strongmen or caudillos, by dictators. In the aftermath of independence, these caudillos did not believe that the new nation could survive without foreign protection. Spain, in fact, reinvades and reannexes the colony in 1861. This is unprecedented, unlike any of the other movements we've seen. And a new war for independence breaks out called the War of Restoration. The Spanish do not leave the island for the last time until 1865. The president in the 1870s, Buenaventura Báez, then begins to negotiate with the United States and the Grant administration to annex the Dominican Republic to the United States. There are a lot of shady financial deals going on behind the scenes to pull this off. A treaty is signed and is narrowly defeated in the U.S. Senate. Senator Charles Sumner is usually credited with the defeat of this treaty, and he once said, "The resolution before the Senate, this treaty, commits Congress to a dance of blood. President Báez is sustained in power by the government of the United States so that he may betray his own country." It is a sorry episode that speaks volumes about the political leadership in both countries. The Spanish West Indies, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Santo Domingo provide us with counterexamples to the successes in the wars for independence across the Americas. First, they clearly demonstrate that despite the converging forces of intellectual, political, and economic ferment, independence in colonial America in the early 19th century is not inevitable and it's not unavoidable. Second, geography and size matter. These are small islands with small populations that are much more easily defended and held than the large colonies on the mainland. In addition, their proximity to the United States and the growing power of the United States also helped Spain, ironically enough, hold on to them for a few more decades. Finally, the absence of charismatic and dynamic political leadership also matters. These colonies do not produce that leadership in the 19th century. The man and the hour do not meet in Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic in the 1810s and 1820s. Unlike the mainland, the island colonies of Spanish America did not fare well in the age of revolution.